I am Paul Harris. Thank you very much for listening. A couple of years ago, Dr. David Agus had a best-selling book called The End of Illness. I love that title, The End of Illness. Really? I picked it up and I went, what does that mean? Really? Is it the end of all illness? And it was a fascinating read. Now he's back with a new one called The Lucky Years, How to Thrive in the Brave New World of Health. Dr. Agus is a professor of medicine and engineering at USC and the head of the USC Westside Cancer Center and the Center for Applied Molecular Medicine. I'm happy to have him on the show today. Hi, Dr. Agus. How are you?
Hi there. I am great. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Why are these the lucky years for health?
It's an amazing time. As you know, there's a coming together of big data, of technology advances, and a readiness that we all are ready to adopt these new technologies. And so literally every week there's a new discovery that's changing our field. And for the first time in my career, I can walk into a room of a patient with advanced disease with a sense of hope and optimism.
When you talk about technology, are you talking about personal technologies to monitor our own health, like Fitbit?
All of the above. So ranging from Fitbit or, you know, you could check your blood pressure at home. You know, the old days, you went to your doctor's office and they collected data. They drew blood. They checked your blood pressure. Now you're going to get all of that at home and go in and actually have a discussion with your doctor. And at the same time, we're making radical discoveries of new ways to treat disease, new ways to understand disease, and new ways to behave, all from big data.
Okay, I want to get to the new discoveries in a moment, but I'm stuck on this personal data thing, because even if I collect all the data about myself, you know, I don't wear a Fitbit, but if I did, I did that, and I checked my blood pressure and all the other stuff that I could do at home, and then I go to my doctor's office, I still need a good doctor who knows how to analyze all that data and then come to the right conclusion.
No question about it. But the old days, you know, your doctor checked your blood pressure at 2 o'clock, and that was it. Now you're going to go in with blood pressure when you got up in the morning, when you go to bed at night, when you're pissed off after a phone call. You know, there's an old adage, with enough data, error goes away. And in this new era, we can start to collect mounds of data and then put it into context so you can really have a discussion. But you're right. Doctors put the data into context. So it's a marriage of you together with your doctor that's going to get the best outcome.
So how are we doing in that? Do we have enough doctors who actually can do the analysis on the data that patients are bringing them?
It's a great question. And, you know, the answer probably is no, but I think medicine is going to change from the ground up, not the top down. When people keep coming in and pushing and with new data, that's what's going to change medicine. You know, we do medical education. We select our doctors who can memorize things. Well, nowadays, with a smartphone in your pocket, you want doctors who can integrate data. So it's a different skill set. And so we need to push for that change, but it's happening and it's exciting.
But isn't the other part of that equation, we also live in a world of maybe even too much information available to us, and that what I mean by that is there's so much misinformation. You know, if somebody collects all this data and then they go online and try to diagnose themselves, as you and I both know lots and lots of people are doing every single day, they could run into the internet wall of misinformation, and now they've got more problems than they had when they started.
Right. So the challenge is not to get afraid of the data, but to put it into context and actually to create utility for it. And I think that's what's going to be exciting. We're at that new era. You know, one of the great data studies came out, for example, that the closer you live to an airport, the higher your rate of brain decline as you get older, implying that our brain needs quiet time at night to actually get ready for the next day. And so I have a 150-pound dog that snores, so I wear earplugs at night to get that quiet time. Well, until this study came out, no doctor even knew to ask about that or what it meant. But now we've put that into context, and so the doctor should be asking, do you live in a city? Do you have double-pane windows? Is it noisy when you go to bed? And that will help him or her make the right decisions.
Ooh, that's a really good one. I like that. Okay, so aside from our habits and our own data collecting, where are we in the world of new health advances? Are we still making giant strides every year?
We are, and it's just, you know, it's so encouraging and exciting. You know, take the field of cancer. You know, Jimmy Carter is a great example. He has skin cancer that went to the brain, and he's a hero for being transparent and talking about what he went through. But just 2-3 years ago, what he had was an immediate death sentence. Now he got a drug that blocks the don't eat me signal that's on every cancer cell, allowing his own immune system to come in and put the cancer under control. So just today he announced that his cancer is still under control. So it was a death sentence is now a life sentence. You couple that with the advances in what we call personalized or precision precision medicine where every patient I have, I can get a DNA sequence, whether it be on the cancer or themselves, literally overnight, and use that information to target an on switch in a disease, not just give them a neutron bomb, which is what chemotherapy and many other treatments were, but actually to target the on switches. And there are dozens of those now that are on the market and available. So it's a new era, really an era of hope.
President Obama the other day announced what is being called a billion-dollar moonshot to cure cancer. The federal government is going to put a lot of money into that. He put Joe Biden in charge of that. Is that going to help?
I was with Vice President Biden in Davos last week, and we had a meeting on it. And I think what's exciting is not the dollars, because $1 billion, believe it or not, it's a pittance compared to what we've spent on cancer. But it's the notion that a leader, Vice President Biden, one of the most powerful people in the country, he said, my job is to take away obstacles, to take away obstacles for progress. And so if I have trouble getting data or using things in a certain way or the FDA approving a drug, he's going to get rid of those obstacles. I really believe that the advances in cancer that are going to come are not going to be from brute force dollars, but really from human ingenuity. And having somebody in power to help remove obstacles to allow us to have progress will be very powerful.
I realize that the goal is to someday cure cancer, but is the short-term goal to turn it into a manageable condition that you can live with?
I think it's the long-term goal, too. I don't think we will ever cure cancer. I mean, to me, cancer is a verb, not a noun. You don't get cancer. You have cancer. And so my job as a cancer doctor is not to target the cancer cell and kill it. It's to change your body so the cancer doesn't want to happen. A wild study came out where they looked at the eyelid. It's the only part of the body you don't put sunscreen on. And when they looked there, they found every DNA change associated with cancer, yet they didn't have cancer. Because you don't just need to have the changes in DNA. You need a receptive environment. So one of the ways we're going to manage cancer in the future is to change those environments. At the same time, we're learning a staggering amount from outliers. Elephants are 40 times bigger than you or I, yet they don't get cancer. They have 40 times more cells and no cancer. Well, it turns out that elephants give birth until their 60s, protect the herd until their 70s, the male, so they can't get cancer. So they developed a system where they have a gene. We have one copy of a gene that corrects DNA called P53. They have 20 copies because they can't afford to get cancer. We need to learn from these outliers.
Are we going to have more DNA testing of humans to expose things like congenital diseases or other things that are passed generation to generation?
With information and knowledge comes power. And so DNA is a piece to that puzzle. I think there are going to be things further than DNA, looking at the proteins, looking at the bacteria, looking at all aspects of it. And it's going to allow us to personalize what we do, to give the right dose of the right medicine at the right time to the right patient. But technology is enabling that. So instead of one size fits all, we can really start to treat things differently.
In the book, you talk about personalized medicine, or you call it precision medicine. And there's part of me that wonders, is that only going to be for rich people?
That's the cool thing about the lucky years. These new technologies, they're democratizing health, is that it actually brings down costs dramatically. In an era where drug costs are going up, technology costs are rather inexpensive and getting cheaper. And so if we can start to do the right thing in the long run, it's a lot cheaper. And so these are technologies that are available to all of us, and I think will actually make medicine better, whether you're rich or whether you're poor.
All right, I've just got to ask you one other question here before we go.
Sure.
Americans don't like big pharmaceutical companies because in so many cases they're charging so much for their medicine, and you know, we see all these ads and hear the disclaimers and what the side effects can be, and so people are skeptical of that. I think skepticism is a good thing, although sometimes it goes too far and people believe nonsense that they've read online or heard from pseudo-celebrities. But when it comes to big pharma, maybe because they only encounter it when they have huge medical costs, they have a bad relationship with that. However, the other side of that coin is Americans love big vitamin. Why? Why do we love big vitamin and big supplements?
First of all, it's the same companies making both. So realize the biggest vitamin makers are the Roches, the Novartis, the same people that make the drugs.
People don't know that, though.
But it's an empowering thing. I'm taking a vitamin to make myself better. I went to the fast food restaurant 3 times a week. I'm going to counteract it with this vitamin.
Yeah.
You know, we spend more on vitamins and supplements than in all of medical research. By the way, we spend more on potato chips than on cancer research in the United States of America.
Wow.
And yet there's never been a positive study in the history of man or womankind showing a vitamin or supplement has a benefit. And at the same time, there are plenty of studies showing they cause harm. And so I look at this, and you're right, I scratch my head, but we need to change it. You know, you're right that there are some people taking advantage of drug pricing and taking advantage of individuals by raising the price. But at the same time, if we don't encourage innovation, we're not going to have new treatments for many of the ailments that we will all suffer. So we need a balancing act between them.
Yeah.
And so I think the challenge is to create that balancing act going forward. And that's why I'm excited that the Vice President Biden's of the world are getting into this mix.
Yeah. It's so frustrating to me because I see whole stores and whole sections of stores devoted to these supplements that nobody's ever had any proof that they actually do anything. But then again, I can't get Walgreens to stop selling homeopathic remedies.
You're right. But I mean, listen, if a man takes vitamin E at 3 years, they have a 17% increase in prostate cancer. So we say take the vitamin E, and then society pays for your cancer that you get from it. Something's wrong there. We all have a right to do what we want in our country. We can smoke. We can be as large as we want. We can sit all day. But at the same time, does society have the obligation to pay for the healthcare ramifications of our behavior? It's a critical question that we're going to have to answer going forward.
Dr. David Agus is the professor of medicine and engineering at USC and head of the Westside Cancer Center and the Center for Applied Molecular Medicine. His new book is a great read. It's called The Lucky Years, How to Thrive in the Brave New World of Health. Thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thank you. It's my privilege.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.